This is Focus. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producer for the program is Harriet Williamson. Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour, and Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. In this part of Focus, we are going to be talking about mental health issues on college campuses. And it is certainly the case that on campuses across the country, the mental health of students is a growing concern. But the question is, well, really, what do we know about the national student population? How many students today experience something like depression or anxiety? How many students are taking medication? How well do schools respond to their needs? Well, those are some of the kind of questions that we want to take up this morning in this hour of Focus. And we will be talking with Dr. Ben Locke. He is the Associate Director for Clinical Services at the Center for Counseling and Psychological Services at Penn State. So we'll be bringing you the point of view of someone who works in this area and has also done some thinking about it and some research about what is going on college campuses across the country. And certainly we have a lot of surveys and a lot of data saying that there's a bigger problem today than there has been in the past. Certainly, if we go back, say, just about 10 years, that it seems that growing numbers of students are going down to the local counseling center at their university and seeking help with some of the problems of student life. So they're stressed as a result of their studies. They may have issues that have to do with just living life. On the other hand, though, we're also told that the numbers of college students that may be coming to college with some kind of history of serious mental illness, that has increased. And we have students that are taking medication, sometimes powerful medications. And there is an argument to be made that says, in fact, that that's a good thing, because now we have students who are in college, able to be in college, that because they're taking medication and because they have received treatment, that in the past they wouldn't have been able to attend college. But that does sort of place a greater burden on administrations and on health services, because students like that do need support. So we'll be talking here in this part of a Focus with Dr. Ben Locke. And as we do that, questions and comments certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that was good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And in any case, whichever number works for you, you can use that number. You can give us a call. We'd be very happy to have your questions, comments. We can take email as well if you'd like to send in your thoughts that way. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. And at any point here, certainly you can call in. And Dr. Locke, hello.
Hello.
Thanks very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
Hi, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Yeah, no, I'm glad we could do the show. We seem to have a hard time getting it together, but I'm really glad that we could be doing it. And certainly, because the kind of thing that we're talking about here is, I know it is an issue, and I'm sure that people who work as counselors, but also administrators and parents and students, people all across the country, it's something that we are hearing more about, and I think that people are more concerned about. So I'm glad that we could be talking about it.
Yeah, it's certainly an important issue that certainly has our attention year after year.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about how it is one even gets a handle on the scope of the problem, because we are told that both that growing numbers of students are seeking counseling, so just the sheer number of students that may be stopping in to see you or people like you at across the country, that's increasing.
Mm-hmm.
But also it seems that the severity of the problems that students present with, that's also increasing. I mean, I know you've done some study of this. What can you say about, generally speaking, about students today and what sort of issues they come with?
Sure, sure. Well, just to touch on the first part of your question, getting a handle on the scope of the problem has been a major challenge for the field for, decades at this point. And part of the problem has been that you know, essentially as long as counseling centers have existed on college campuses, well, and especially the last 20 to 30 years, they have been full. So no matter how much staffing they have had, they are always full once the year begins, and in many cases there's a wait for service. So there's a finite capacity in most schools, and that capacity is almost always nearly full. And if you add on an additional staff member or two, typically the center is then again full. So it's very hard to evaluate the actual true demand because the centers providing the services have this finite capacity. But what seems clear if you talk with counseling centers and their administrators across the country is that year after year, the demand for services, the number of individuals knocking on the door saying, you know, I need some help with X, Y, or Z, is increasing. It's very, very rare that you'll talk with a counseling center director who says, geez, actually, we went down this year. And if they do go down, it's usually temporary. So similarly, severity is also a challenge to track. There have been some studies out there that suggest that the kinds of things that students are coming in seeking services for have changed over the years. But increasingly, if you talk with folks who are working in counseling centers, they will talk very openly about the change in the kinds of presenting problems. So historically, let's say, counseling centers might have been described as serving students who have had, less severe life challenges, like a breakup, like adjustment from home, difficulty choosing a major, minor bouts of depression, things like that. Today, counseling centers are coping with the full range of mental health diagnoses, from the least severe to the most severe, including all forms of hospitalization for threat to self, threat to others, psychotic experiences, and so forth. And one of the other indicators that things have become different is the changing in the way that counseling centers are staffed. For example, it used to be that counseling centers just kind of had an open walk-in model. Many years ago, they added in crisis systems where students who were in crisis could get more rapid services. In the last, say, 5 to 10 years, counseling centers have begun to add a triage layer to their services, and triage is typically something you find on a battlefield or an emergency room. That's been added because we need to really rapidly evaluate how severe the need is so that we can prioritize the order in which people get served. And then most recently, taking a cue from community mental health care, counseling centers around the country are adding case managers whose sole responsibility is to help students find the services they need. When you have a student land on campus who's going to need 4 or 5 years of ongoing care, whether it's psychiatric or counseling or both, that can be challenging to do given all the different kinds of health insurance that are out there. But each of those different areas sort of speak to this increase in scope, increase in severity, and the challenge that the centers face.
If you take a look at mental health of college students and you try to do some assessment of how many students experience what kind of problem, so how much depression, how much anxiety, how much schizophrenia, how much bipolar, you do all that, and you try as best as you can to get a picture of that. And then you take a look at people of the same age, but people who are not in college.
Right.
Are the two, and I know people have done this kind of study, are the two groups comparable?
Well, so in terms of the students who are actually in college, it has historically been thought that when people are in college, it's actually protective, or the set of factors that allow them to go to college, for example, financial setting, educational achievements, et cetera, are protective factors that would keep them from experiencing mental health concerns. One of the things that has been changing in the last, let's say, 20 to 30 years is that college is increasingly becoming the assumed next step for a larger and larger percentage of the population. So 20 or 30 years ago, an individual who really struggled with anxiety, panic attacks, and depression, let's say low self-esteem, might have simply self-selected out of going to college. And in that scenario, if you were to examine those who are in college and out, you might find that fewer people in college struggle with mental health issues than the general population. One of the things that seems to be happening is that, there's a couple pieces to this. One is that more and more people are choosing to go to college regardless of what it is they're struggling with, because college plays an increasingly important role in the job market and the sort of general progression of education. But if you add to that the early diagnoses or the ability for people to get an earlier diagnosis, let's say childhood or middle school, and then to have effective treatments that work, that allow them to move on towards graduation and then become eligible to go to college, what you find is that more and more people are able to be are eligible to go in addition to sort of the societal expectation. So even though it is probably true today that on the whole, the relative rates of mental illness within the college setting are somewhat lower than the general population, and I apologize, I can't give you exact numbers there. It also seems to be the case that that those numbers are probably moving closer to each other for a variety of reasons. And I can give you one really specific example. Many of us have heard about the rise in autism or autism spectrum diagnoses, and some of this is diagnostic in nature. Some of it appears to be, that the incidence is actually increasing in the general population. And so on the higher end of the autism spectrum are individuals who are functioning fairly well in their day-to-day life, but they still have some functional impairments. And one group of diagnoses in there, or individuals in there, might have a diagnosis called Asperger's disorder or Asperger's syndrome, with marked impairments around social interaction, for example. Increasingly, in secondary education, these individuals would experience what we would call wraparound services that would allow them to have the therapy and the one-to-one attention in their classes and getting their work done, homework, family support, all the rest of it. Many years ago, even a decade ago, many of these individuals simply would not have gone to school because either they had trouble getting through high school or it just was clear to everybody that this was not going to work well in college. Today, these individuals are really achieving remarkable levels of educational success and are eligible and certainly intelligent enough to go to school. But the challenges that were managed within a wraparound service model in secondary ed are very difficult to manage in higher education. So that's just one example of this trend of increasing severity and prevalence on campuses.
Our guest in this hour of focus is Dr. Ben Locke. He is the Associate Director for Clinical Services at the Center for Counseling and Psychological Services at Penn State University. We're talking about college student mental health. What are some of the current trends that we can identify, and what are some of the challenges that counseling centers like the one where he works have in trying to respond to the needs of students? We have a couple of callers. We'd take as many as we can. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll free 800-222-9455. We also have email if you want to send us something that way, will-talk@illinois.edu. Here's our first caller in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I was wondering before, or maybe after you talked to us this hour, are there some websites that you could recommend that you might send to Focus 580 to post for us? In particular, I'm wondering what kind of preparation parents and students can have before they come to the campus so they understand the resources and the situation and that they know what they perhaps might tell the medical center or the counseling center, if that's appropriate, so that you have some idea and also some information for the advisors and people who work with these students. I can, in fact, remember that I had a young man come in who was, in fact, high-functioning autistic, but I didn't recognize it. I recognized that we weren't quite communicating, and it wasn't until his mother called and spoke to me that I understood what that was, and mm-hmm. I didn't know how plugged in he was to the counseling center. And I wonder if some of these kids come on campus without any of us knowing, while that's private information, if the parents have the opportunity to plug in someplace if they wish, how does that work? And are there resources that we can read about or think about when we're working with students and see to it that they get to the counseling center or the mental health center or the McKinley Health Center or whatever, and that the parents and the students can have this kind of figured out a bit before they hit the campus?
Yeah, it's a great question. There's a couple different components there I can address. The first part you mentioned is, are there websites, are there resources? And the best recommendation I can offer to a parent who's considering sending their son or daughter to college is to actually go to the university or college's website and do a search for counseling or mental health. Typically, counseling center will get you your best hit. And each counseling center will typically have the services that they offer listed right there on their website, along with a lot of additional resources that may be of interest to parents or future students. In fact, many counseling center websites will have a subsection specifically for parents and faculty and staff. These are all individuals who work with college students in one capacity or another, obviously parents as parents. So because the resources can vary by institution, it's a really good starting place to look at the institution that you're interested in going to get a better sense of what kind of resources are available. And in terms of the portion of your question regarding training for people working in colleges and universities, one of the primary functions of college counseling centers is outreach and training of the university community, both peers, faculty, staff, and administrators in and around mental health issues. And so if you're working on a college or university campus and you're curious about these kinds of issues, you're wondering about how to deal with students of this concern or that concern, I would really encourage folks to contact the counseling center directly and ask for a training program or an outreach event where they come in and give a talk about how to work with students with these kinds of challenges or how to support students in this kind of a situation. They can really be a great resource.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you. And I am right now looking at, just for example, the page for the Counseling Center here at the University of Illinois.
Yep.
And you can go here to the section where they have a section on counseling services. And, for example, it has, I'm just reading down the major categories, tips for coping with traumatic events, student concerns, specialized assessments, frequently asked questions, group counseling, alcohol and drug counseling, suicide prevention, confidentiality, and then there are a lot of other services. So at least that would be a place for people to get a start if they want to know, well, what is available at the Counseling Center of the University of Illinois.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that the University of Illinois Counseling Center is a fantastic center with a really broad reach of services. They are out and about across campus, training and involved in all aspects of university life, from preventative work where they meeting with student groups or faculty or administrators, or work after an event has occurred. And really, your listing off of those services is a great example of why you want to go to the counseling center at the institution you're interested in, because the kinds of services may vary. One other point that's probably worth making is that sometimes parents do send students to school without contacting the institution, and that is their prerogative, and how and when their son or daughter receives treatment is a family and decision. One of the challenges that can arise sometimes, though, is that if a new student arrives on campus with a history of mental health concerns, whether that's ongoing treatment or prior diagnoses, medications, that it really behooves everybody if there is some planning done in advance. In the services available by Counseling Center really vary greatly. And many, or if not most, universities these days are going to some kind of a brief or short-term treatment model where they are not necessarily able to treat all students coming in the door as long as they want. And so it's, you know, in terms of treating your son or daughter in the future, you really want to plan ahead. And the counseling center is a resource on campus that may be able to provide some brief treatment. But typically, given the imbalance between demand and supply, what will often happen if somebody needs ongoing treatment is they will refer that individual into the community to set up a long-term set of relationships. And that can be done before somebody ever arrives on campus.
Let's go to another caller here, Belgium, line number 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning. Good morning to you all. I understand that that there's a lot of people with mental health issues, and I understand that these conditions that you're talking about just recently with autism and things like that, they're a minority in the general public, and I'm sure they're probably a minority in the people that you see. But I'm wondering what another aspect of our societal changes might be affecting what you're talking about, and that being any more students that are coming to see you now, right now, are ones that have grown up in this informational society where you have texting and emailing and all these things that we do now that take the person out of the actual society and keep them more isolated inside themselves. And then they're also presented with the multitude of problems that we've had recently in the last 10 years, wars and horrible recessions and this financial malaise that is causing more and more problems for their financial situation. And then you go to a situation just like you and Penn State have had for the last year here, a very disruptive occurrence that is messing with your campus. And every university probably has those things of one level or another, maybe not quite as severe as Penn State right now.
Mm.
But these items, they bring into the university with you, and we see a lot more. You're talking about a lot more mental health problems. Is this indicative of what we are going to face as a society as these children also grow older and older?
Boy, this is, I mean, it's just such a great question. So in part, you're speaking to the broader issue of how is society changing such, or maybe the changes in the larger society are partly responsible for this sort of growing demand on college and university campuses. And boy, there's a lot of pieces and parts to this. I completely endorse the notion that as our society changes, so does the impact on counseling centers or the need for services. And, you know, this topic is really hotly debated. Some people will point to the fact that the number of people going to college is increasing year after year after year after year, and that's part of the reason for the increase. Some people will point to the early diagnosis and early treatment making it possible for people to go on to college. Some people will often talk about the sort of diagnosing normality. So there's a new version of the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistic Manual, coming out in the next couple of years. And one of the sort of debates raging around this new manual is some of the new proposed diagnoses which appear to tap into areas of normal experience. And, you know, if people self-identify as having a disorder or are labeled as having a disorder, does that then lead to the need for more services? All really great questions and factors. And from my perspective, I think there probably are a set of relationships there, although it's kind of hard to tease them apart. One of the pieces anecdotally that we seem to encounter in counseling centers is the question of resilience, people's ability to cope with adversity successfully. And one of the sort of trends that you'll hear people talk about across the university, not just in counseling center, is that students increasingly who go to college increasingly come from very planned, very contained lives, of course with huge amounts of variety. But in order to be the successful applicant to a competitive school, you have to have been so busy and so focused for so long, seeking to attain the goals of those around you and seeking to sort of achieve those things, but not really necessarily experiencing crisis, not really being let down in really significant ways. And that, you know, invariably when you do come to college, you start to experience real difficulties and challenges outside of the sort of home nest, if you will, and that the first time you experience that can be very daunting and that some of that may contribute. All of these are definitely potential factors. speaking specifically to the issue of large campus events or events on a university campus that impact that entire community or culture, Virginia Tech is a very good example. Clearly, the Sandusky scandal at Penn State is another one. These kinds of events also increase demand on counseling centers, although they do so in pretty variable ways depending on the nuances of that campus and university. In cases of sexual assault or legal trials like we've been experiencing locally here, the impact that you tend to see is that it is activating for individuals who already have these kinds of traumas in their background. And if there is a silver lining there, it leads them to seek additional services and support, and that's hopefully a positive thing. In cases like Virginia Tech or Northern Illinois where there are campus shootings, what you find is a very different result where individuals no longer feel safe or they feel traumatized, they feel anxious, they feel overwhelmed, they're frightened, and people seek services for those reasons. So it is, there are a lot of factors that play a role in determining this kind of increase in prevalence and severity that we're seeing.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. Sure. Well, just as we have noted, as you have noted here, and as anybody who's been to college or has kids who've gone to college knows, this in a person's life can be a stressful time. You know, it may be you're living away from home for the first time, and it's a time that you're trying to figure out who you are and what you're going to be and where you're going in life. And you can be experiencing things that are really new and unfamiliar. And, you know, people are trying to find partners and get hooked up. And, you know, there's all kinds of stuff that's going on here that can make this very difficult. And that's probably always been a part of the college experience. But having said all that, do you think that student life is any more stressful today than it was 10 or 20 or 30 years ago?
Great question. Well, had I been a student 40 or 50 years ago, I could give you a really firm answer on that. What I hear is that college has always been somewhat stressful for people. But in the 90s, there's at least one article I can think of out there where folks began to document a shifting from sort of everyday upsets and concerns coming into counseling centers to stress levels and anxiety levels beginning to really kind of peak and be a primary concern. Today, if you were to look at the primary presenting concerns that students are coming into counseling centers with, usually the number one concern that we're seeing is anxiety, and very closely behind it is depression. And, that kind of anxiety is usually tied to the pressures of being in college, the pressures of being successful, the pressures of kind of getting on in the world. It does seem as if the pressures that are on students today are just kind of continuing to grow. I'm thinking of somebody I just spoke with yesterday who, you know, is wanting to go on to medical school, has been pursuing this for years and years and years. The parents lost their jobs in the last year. There's no medical insurance to seek care with, to seek health insurance. Like many other students, in addition to, you know, trying to get a 3.5 plus GPA, this individual is working multiple jobs year-round. And so when you look at those kinds of cases, it is very stressful. And stress is one of those things that tends to accumulate over time. If you're stressed for a month or two, most people will recover pretty quickly. If you're under high levels of stress for year after year after year after year, then what happens is the body starts to adjust to that constant level of stress and may have difficulty adjusting in a healthy way to that kind of anxiety, and then that can lead to more prolonged difficulties.
We're talking in this hour of focus about college student mental health. Our guest is Dr. Ben Locke from Penn State. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, why so many American students finish college with crushing debt burdens. We speak with Kevin Carey, director of the Education Policy Program at the New America Foundation. He says tuitions have skyrocketed because colleges spend on big buildings, sports teams, and administration, and new lower-cost competitors may force them to change. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting audiences to enjoy Krannert Uncorked, a weekly free wine tasting almost every Thursday at 5 p.m. in the lobby. On June 28th, Matt Torino and Kate Fritz will treat audiences to an evening of Scottish and Irish fiddle music.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Tomorrow morning on the show, in the 10 o'clock hour, our guest will be Bryce Hoffman. He's a journalist who's written a lot about the auto industry, and we will talk about a book that he's authored. The title is American Icon. It takes a look at a particular period in the history of the Ford Motor Company. This was the time when Alan Mulally was the CEO. And this was a time when the auto industry was in a lot of trouble. And under Mulally's leadership, Ford really came back from the brink and went on to become the most profitable car company in the world. So it's a little bit about how all that happened. That's tomorrow morning at 10 in the 11 o'clock hour. Tomorrow, Jim Harms will be our guest. He is an orthopedic surgeon. He works at the Carl Spine Institute, and occasionally he's here. And we talk about the back, all the things that can go wrong with your back, and how you can take better care of it. That's tomorrow. You check the schedule to find out what we'll do in the days ahead by going to the website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. In this hour of Focus, our guest is Dr. Ben Locke. He is Associate Director for Clinical Services at the Center for Counseling and Psychological Services at Penn State. And we're talking about college student mental health. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Also, you can send us an email if you want, will-talk@illinois.edu. We have another caller in Savoy. We'll go there next. This is line one. Hello.
Good morning. Tiny quickie first. Is the Mulally you just mentioned related to the Mulally that used to be there at Will?
No.
Okay. And sorry to hear you're leaving. You've been quite wonderful.
Thank you.
Got two areas of questions. The first one is about alcohol. I remember some years ago being quite surprised when one of my patients says to me, blah, 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 going out and doing some serious drinking. I'd never heard anybody speak of it that way before. And then, of course, it wasn't too long after that that this stuff comes out in the literature about binge drinking. So my first question is, what are the students, what words are they using nowadays to talk about this? And is binge drinking leveling off, going up, or going down?
Well, great question. I mean, this topic of binge drinking is an enormous problem for colleges and universities around the country. Exactly what words they're using for it these days, I think going out and doing serious drinking is about as close to it as anything else. And I can offer a couple numbers on this. In addition to my role as clinical director at the Counseling Center, I'm also the executive director of the Center for Collegiate Mental Health. And we pool data from from over 100 college and university counseling centers around the country. And some of the things that we look at are these sort of standardized questions that we ask students to answer when they come in. And in our most recent data set from this, we had about 74,000 students. When you look at the percentage of students who report binge drinking in the last 2 weeks, about 56% are reporting no binge drinking at all in the last 2 weeks. On the flip side of that, about 45% are reporting binge drinking in the last 2 weeks. And, the indicators that I hear from colleges and universities are that binge drinking is either going up. Generally speaking, the impression is that it is increasing in the general student body, but also it's not that simple. There appears to be a fairly large group of students at most universities who really don't drink in a binge drinking kind of way, but there are also a lot of students who binge drink regularly. And at a couple different universities I've worked at, I've heard reports of students going out drinking Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday nights, and it has a real impact. One of the and just to clarify that, it has a real impact on their life, on their academic and work goals, but also on the university as a whole. And certainly one of the real challenges there is that assaults of all kinds, especially sexual assaults, typically involve binge drinking of some kind. I think one of the things that is being done that is potentially effective is kind of a 1-2 punch, if you will, where students are being educated in a required manner when they arrive on campus about drinking and the some of the impacts of it, and offering students alternatives to drinking, but also that increasingly colleges and universities are adopting kind of an intervention or a treatment plan for students who kind of get into trouble with drinking. So students who end up in an emergency room, students who break code of conduct for some reason. I think historically students were not intervened with necessarily in a really systematic way. And increasingly, I think institutions are trying to do that as one way of addressing this. Certainly within mental health, broadly speaking, heavy binge drinking and or drug use is strongly associated with all kinds of mental health issues, especially on the higher end. But it is a relatively smaller percentage of people whose binge drinking is tightly tied to mental health issues.
Have you got a few categories of why do they do it? And related to that is, do any of them know they're destroying brain cells?
Well, I think almost any student who's been through health education in their secondary school system will know that, you know, alcohol and drugs and drugs destroy brain cells. I think really what universities are up against is the sociocultural expectations and patterns that exist out there, especially around how to have fun, how to socially interact. And certainly one of the things that I think has changed some is a kind of loosening of the formalities and the ways in which people meet each other, where it used to be sort of through an activity, through kind of formal dating, if you will, whereas today it is, you know, kind of getting together and drinking and then meeting people in that way. If there is a really consistent theme to the draw to go out and drinking, the two that I hear most, and I think my colleagues would endorse this, are letting go of the stress, letting go of the expectations, but also going out to have fun and to meet people.
I came across something a couple times in the last few weeks that I'm going to reword it my way.
I'm going to have to tell you, with a really, really bad hum on your phone line, and it's making it almost impossible for us to hear you.
Oh, okay.
That's a little better.
Okay, I just pushed the wires in there. Thank you for telling me.
Sure.
The basis is I'm concerned, and, you know, I'm not the only one that's got this idea. I've seen it in print a few places. And I think this is mainly for high school problems, should not be for grade school and middle school. And that is more students looking for the ADHD medicine so that they can push it and study more and accomplish more.
Mm-hmm.
If that's true, I'd be interested in hearing what your context and contacts about that is. I will share... Before you do that my concern is that we have too many college wannabe teachers in high school, and they're not really trying to teach to the biggest of the bell-shaped curve in high school. They just want to try to play like they're all got honor students and that sort of thing, and this makes the lower 50% have to struggle more, and I don't think that's what high school should be. But anyway, what can you share about that?
Well, broadly speaking, one of the things that seems to be clear is that the things that used to be reserved for older folks are increasingly happening to younger folks. And if you want to really broaden that, you can just look at the occurrence of puberty and how young that is occurring in people. Similarly, things like ADD used to be diagnosed in sort of in the teenage years and older. Is being diagnosed at younger and younger and younger ages, and younger people are being medicated. There's a real challenge related to ADD in that lots of people are under a lot of pressure to perform really well in order to get, in order to meet their goals. And there is increasingly a belief that medications can help me perform better. And so there is a pull for people to seek medications to improve their performance, even if ultimately it's not going to help. And of course, one of the intersecting challenges with that is that the medications used to treat ADD are also abused. Ritalin, Adderall, and some of the other ones are sort of sold on the black market on college campuses, in part to increase performance, but also for other reasons. And so we have this sort of dual challenge when an individual comes in interested or let's say concerned about symptoms related to ADD and interested in medication. Is this an individual who truly needs, well, first of all, who actually has ADD, or are there other things going on such as anxiety that are creating a performance problem? If, in fact, they do have ADD, is it at a level where medication is really going to help, or is it really more about learning better study skills? And then kind of tying right into that, is this individual actually going to take the medication as prescribed in a way that is shown to work? Are they going to abuse it in some way? And then even more worrisome, are they going to sell it? And we frequently run into this problem on college campuses where drugs, and not just college campuses, but in general, that drugs are being sold for other purposes than that which they're prescribed for. So the press to perform well begins very, very early, and then it just continues through college, and ADD and the medications for that play a role there. One related factor in this is that primary care physicians are increasingly able and willing to prescribe medications for mental health-related issues, for example, SSRI medications for depression or anxiety and or ADD. But one of the challenges with that is that that they can overprescribe or prescribe too quickly when additional assessment and or other interventions would be tried first by a mental health professional. And sometimes what we see is that a student coming to college who's been given an ADD medication by a primary care physician, really trying to meet the best interests of their patient, ends up expecting and wanting to have that medication in college when, in fact, they may not even have ADD. Or they may have symptoms that would really be better treated in a different way. So this is a real challenge for institutions.
We're coming to the point where we have maybe about 7 or 8 minutes left. We have a couple of callers. We'll try to get them both. Just again, I'll introduce our guest, Dr. Ben Locke. He works at the Center for Counseling and Psychological Services at Penn State. And we're talking about college student mental health. And your questions are welcome. We'll just go on here. Next, we'll talk with someone in Mattoon. This is line number two. Hello.
Mm-hmm. I would echo, David, sorry to see you go. I also had a comment. I teach at Eastern Illinois University, and we have a wonderful Office of Disability Concerns, and you were talking about resources for parents and faculty staff. The Counseling Center is certainly one of those resources. I would say for things like autism and that sort of stuff, the Office of Disability Concerns at Eastern has been wonderful. I was working with a student who had Asperger's, high-functioning autism, and not only did the Office of Disability Concern educate me, send me a whole bunch of information about this, I also had a student who was a double major in communication studies and communication disorders and sciences, and she was enrolled in the same course. And so we were actually able to work out a plan where she could tutor him and the student with autism, and we were actually able to get a talented student award for her. So she actually ended up getting about $2,000, and that was in part because the Office of Disability Concerns thought that I was going to have a graduate student to help. I said, no, that's news to me. That's not happening. But I knew this student, and so we were actually able to work out a really useful plan, which was helpful to her because she wants to work with people in the future with similar problems, and also helpful to him. So parents should be aware of that, and also staff and faculty. I mean, if you do have a student, talk to your folks there as well. They can often give you really, really good information that can be helpful.
Right. Yeah, great points. The Office of Disability Services varies by campus in terms of where it's located and what their coverage is, but and sometimes they're actually located in counseling centers or under that umbrella, but that's a very, very good point.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, let's go on to another caller here, Champagne, line three. Hello.
Hi. First of all, David, I want to echo the previous people who are sorry to see you leaving for the greener pastures of retirement. It's been a delight listening to you and occasionally working with you over the years. I think, frankly, it's one of the best interview programs I've ever heard. But to your callers, to your guest, Dr. Hates, interest, a previous caller asked about comparing things to 50 years ago. And as someone who was in college 50 years ago, maybe I can help a little bit.
Okay.
It raises some interesting questions. 50 years ago, you know, the end of the Eisenhower administration, beginning of the Kennedy administration, was, among other things, a very optimistic time. You know, anyone who got a college degree was going to get a job somewhere. So, you know, people were majoring in weird things like I did, without actually worrying about whether they could get a job because they figured they could anyway. And I think that one of the things that plays into this question of student anxiety and mental health is precisely that, the anxieties attached to the current economy and you know, levels of unemployment that are double or triple what they were when I was in college. But the other thing that I'd mention is that, now, it may just be that I never availed myself of it, but and therefore didn't know, but I don't even recall there being such a thing as a counseling center for undergraduates when I was in school 50 years ago. I'm sure there was something in the student health service, but no one ever made a point of advising us that, you know, if you're feeling depressed or hyper-anxious or hyperactive or XYZ, there's this place. So that, you know, it wasn't a public issue in the way that it is today. The other thing is that, you know, undergraduates today, particularly at public institutions, are much more likely to be balancing not just, you know, their academic responsibilities and the problems of becoming an adult in a strange and new place, but they're also dealing with levels. You know, they've got, I don't remember what the, I don't know exactly what the proportions are, but when I ask my students in lecture courses, usually 60 to 65% of my students are holding down some kind of a job while they're going to school.
Right.
And many of them are also building up, you know, what we now have nationally, they say, $1 trillion in student debt.
Yeah.
So they've got a number of things going on in their lives that are virtually certain to produce anxiety.
Right. I can really echo each point that you've made, that the complexity of a student's life today and the number of burdens that they carry simultaneously really does seem to be qualitatively different even 20, 30 years ago in terms of the number of people who are working. And just to touch on the sort of history of mental health services on campuses really briefly, they really started after World War II. And for the first, you know, 10 to 20 years after that, they weren't all that common. And they've grown pretty dramatically since then, and they often weren't sort of widely advertised, as one of their primary purposes was returning vets in their sort of early incarnation.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very possible that you would have never heard of it or never seen it because it wasn't advertised. They didn't necessarily do outreach, but they served a more specific purpose, if they existed at all on a college mm-hmm. campus.
Yeah, in fact, I don't recall now. You know, I came from a solidly middle-class family in the New York suburbs, but I don't recall ever even hearing the term health insurance until after college.
Right.
You know, and the idea of being disqualified from the health insurance that we didn't have because no one, we didn't feel we needed it.
Yeah.
There are just lots and lots of other anxiety-producing things, and the further one is that I'll just put in a pitch for public higher education. As a sort of final word here, is that 50 years ago, most public higher education was free or virtually free. You know, I was in school in New York City, and I went to Columbia, but City College of New York was free. You know, tuition at the University of Michigan was about $200, and you know, the you know, the degree to which states have pulled out of funding higher education and turned that over to the responsibility of the students themselves is another thing that just makes life much, much, much more difficult for them.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you,
well, thank you
for the opportunity to talk with you.
Sure, thanks.
I'll get off and let David finish the program.
Thank you very much. Let me just real quickly raise a completely different issue. Apparently the person who was implicated in the shooting that took place at Northern Illinois University in 2008, from having talked to somebody who's done some reporting on this, was somebody who, when he was younger, had a history of mental illness. During the time that he went to university, he apparently was doing pretty well. Something happened to put him into a very serious emotional slide, and the result was this violent outburst. You want to protect students' privacy, but how much right do universities have to know about what sort of experiences students have had when they get there? And you know, for all the right reasons, you might want to say we should know about this so that we can make sure that students are pointed in the direction of resources mm-hmm. that can help. But on the other hand, you know, there are some concerns about their privacy that you want to respect.
Wow, you know, this is a whole other talk show or two.
Yeah.
But to very briefly address it, you know, since these campus tragedies have occurred in the last 10 years especially, what you're seeing across the country are the creation of variously named teams, from students of concern committees to behavioral threat assessment teams or threat assessment teams. And the job of these teams is to really try to balance the right to privacy and as an individual with the safety of the community. And while it is not always mental health issues that lead people to become a threat to themselves or others, it is often intertwined. And the two are somewhat at odds, where in the case of mental health treatment, there's very strict laws regarding privacy and confidentiality about sort of history and background. And with regard to protecting the safety of a community, The general leaning is to override civil liberties for the purpose of protecting everybody. And so one of the real challenges that mental health intersects with in higher education is balancing these two somewhat disparate needs that intersect in a real tension. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think there is not a right for institutions to know people's history, and I think my hope is that that kind of privacy will remain intact. On the other hand, I think once you become a member of a college or university, that your actions, your behaviors on campus may bring you under greater scrutiny for the greater good of the yeah. and greater safety.
I'm really sorry, stipulating that you're right, this could be another show. We're going to have to stop there.
Guest,
Ben Locke, Associate Director of Clinical Services, the Center for Counseling and Psychological Services at Penn State. Thanks very much for talking with us.
You're very welcome. It was a pleasure.